This matter comes upon two appeals. There have been many assignments of error presented to the court, but essentially what is before the court is the question of whether a $350,000 judgment that was entered by way of contempt proceeding was properly entered by the court, or whether it should be reversed and set aside. There are two main arguments that the RHI presents with respect to its position that the judgment was unlawfully, or at least improperly, entered. The first is that the appellee, Mr. Handback, used this contempt procedure in order to rewrite a July 2000 contract that he was ordered to specifically perform by way of a 2004 decree. And DRHI has submitted probably 17 cases in support of the proposition that as a matter of law, that cannot happen. The other reason why DRHI appeals that entry of that judgment is that it presents dangerous precedent. This Commonwealth has limited the exercise of contempt fines, imprisonment, and judgments to situations involving where, in a domestic case, a person who has a monetary obligation has not abided or honored that obligation. In other instances, when injunctions have been violated, there have been judgments entered. But in no case that I have seen and that the court has been presented, has there ever been an instance where a party to a real estate contract can ask that the court enforce the amount that is due under that contract by way of the contempt powers.
In your view, what would have been the appropriate remedy here to bring this matter to the court?
I would submit that there were two potential approaches that the appellee could have taken. The first approach would have been to file in the case that came before the court in 2004 a declaratory judgment action, or perhaps a request to reform the contract, if he felt that the contract was not clear or did not address what ultimately happened here, which was that this property was developed by way of an assemblage and not simply by his contract. The court will note that in this particular case, what happened was Mr. Handback simply said, this contract is not enforceable, because DRHI breached the contract, and the court found to the contrary. I have cited in the brief how important it is for any litigant who comes into court to identify in his pleadings what he seeks. And in this instance, the only thing that Mr. Handback sought in 2004 was the setting aside of the contract. He did not come into court and say, but if the court does not set aside the contract, I want you to address what will happen in the event that DRHI combines my property with another property, and as a result of that assemblage and a request by the rezoning authority to modify what was my client's initial approach of by right development, what happens then? He did not do that. The second approach that I think Mr. Handback could have taken, if he believed that we were in violation of the terms of the contract with respect to payment, he could have brought a breach of contract action. He could say, you are under an obligation to pay this amount of money, and you did not do that. The problem, of course, is he does not want to pursue that alternative approach, because once you look to the contract is very clear that he is not entitled to the $350,000 that was awarded, nor was he entitled to the alternative amount that he also sought by way of an alternative theory, $35,000, or the other monetary amount that he sought during the contempt hearing, which was $210,000. And I would, at this point, bring to the court's attention that when somebody is accused of being in violation of the court's order, as a preliminary matter, the party who is complaining of that has to come into court and say, here's what the order says, and this is how the other side is in violation of that order. And that didn't happen here. There was no allegation that there was a specific amount. What Mr. Handback did was he improperly used the contempt proceeding to have the court decide which equitable remedy should he be allowed. Should he be allowed an equitable remedy that gave him $35,000 based upon half of an extra lot? Should he be allowed the equitable remedy of $210,000 because his property constituted 53% of the total assemblage, and when you start getting into mathematics, that's what they thought they were owed? Or do you award $350,000 because five lots were not put on his property, but were put on the other property at the request of the city? This case is wrong on many different levels. Or let me say this, the result of this case is wrong on many different levels. First, it was wrong procedurally. Secondly, it was wrong in terms of the law.
But we don't have that question, that second question, before us, do we? I'm looking at your request for relief, and what you're asking us to do is to reverse the judgment of the trial court and dismiss the action, leaving the parties to whatever further actions they might want to file. Is that correct?
That is correct, and the reason why I say that as a matter of law this was improper, or the judgment needs to be set aside, is because, as I said before, the law in Virginia is very clear that in cases of specific performance, which is what we have here, the court cannot, either on its own or through the efforts of the party who is opposing the specific performance, remake the contract.
That may or may not be true. It probably is true. But that's not before us, is it, the way you've teed this up? Whether the trial judge properly interpreted the contract is actually not before us. Now, you've alleged and talked about it a great deal in your brief, and you may be right. But as I look at the way you have set this up before us, we have a case before the court that it proceeded based upon contempt for failure to abide by the, that's an interesting question, a July 9th order, or was it the September 16th order? And that's part of the issue before. But there isn't any request for us to determine whether or not the trial court's interpretation of the contract itself was in error.
Well, I think if I can go to the assignments of error. First of all, what I would say is that no one came before the judge who heard the contempt proceeding and said that this court needed to be construed. There are assignments of error where I say that if that were the situation, he didn't have the power to construe the contract in a way that, excuse me, the decree in a way that was contrary to the contract.
Well, the only one that comes close to that is assignment of error 4. But if you then look at your request for relief in this case, it really doesn't even encompass assignment of error 4. But in any event, assume for the sake of argument here today that the question of whether the trial judge's interpretation of the actual contract was right or wrong, you still have this question of whether or not the court had jurisdiction to proceed by virtue of contempt. And that's your main issue before us.
Well, I think that there are certainly many assignments of error that raise the issue of whether this court had the power or authority to proceed by contempt to do what it did. And if the court takes a look at, for example, assignment of error in 140605, it says that in order for that judgment to stand, the court redrafted the 2001 contract, which the 2004 decree ordered to be specifically enforced. And I'm saying that the court that sat and heard the contempt hearing could not do that.
Right. Now, that has to do with power. It has to do with jurisdiction.
That's
correct. Trial courts have jurisdiction to do things incorrectly. That's error. And what I'm trying to get ferret out here is that you're talking about whether the underlying interpretation of the contract itself, with an addendum, was error. But I don't see that even remotely addressed in what you ask us to do in the case, which leaves for our determination the first and probably primary issue that you have, which is whether or not the court had the power to even render a decision on the subject.
I would say that the court neither had the power to do what it did, nor did it have the jurisdiction to do what it did.
They're the same.
And you're talking
about subject matter jurisdiction here, right?
Can the court proceed to have a contempt hearing? Yes, subject matter. But does, in the exercise of that subject matter jurisdiction, do we get to another issue of jurisdiction, which is, during the exercise of that subject matter jurisdiction, did the court have the jurisdiction to rewrite the contract or the decree? And I have a number of cases which say specifically, I mean, they use the language, the court does not have the jurisdiction.
But isn't there a more fundamental question that comes before that? I mean, it seems to me like you're saying that the court had subject matter jurisdiction to enforce its orders. But isn't a more fundamental question here is whether a court has the authority to issue a show cause to hold someone in contempt because of the failure to pay a monetary judgment.
Absolutely.
And the answer to that is no. Then we reverse, and that's the end of the case. You go back
stops.
And you fight another day on some other cause of action in the trial court.
And I apologize for talking over you so many times.
But that's the only question we really have to answer here, isn't it?
I don't.
Or at least initially.
At least initially. That's correct. And I have the Markroff case that says that you can't do that. The Edens case specifically said a court sitting in equity cannot use its contempt powers to enforce a monetary judgment. I mean, it just says that in that language. 801-467 says that a court can't issue the old writ of capias ad satisfaction. In other words, you can't use the contempt power of the court to enforce a monetary judgment outside of the domestic proceeding. I've got just 3 minutes left, so if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Chap Peterson for the appellee, Mr. Bill Hamback. This matter originally came on a rule to show cause from the 2004 order that was entered by Judge Klein. And that order came from a specific performance case that had been filed by the appellate, in this case DRHI, to force the sale of land owned by my client in Fairfax City.
You're talking about the July 9, 2004 order?
Yes, sir.
Well, now let me ask you a question directly about that.
Yes, sir.
Could you have executed upon that order?
No.
Okay. Now, that's important.
The short answer is no, because there was no liquidated damages at that point.
It seems to me that the fundamental error in this case, if it is error, is that the trial judge treated this just like a domestic relations order for support. And there's statutory support for the concept that every time a payment is due, it is a judgment. But outside of that realm, there is no support that this was a judgment upon which you could execute or collect. So in July 9, 2004, what you have is an order that cannot be executed upon because it's not a money judgment.
That's correct.
Well, how then can the DRHI be found in contempt for not paying a money judgment that wasn't a money judgment?
Because the point is that the order itself anticipated a two-part transaction. One would happen extensive with the closing, which was the payment of the additional $400,000. The second part was when the property was rezoned.
Well, I understand that, but don't you have to adjudicate that question?
Well, that's exactly what we did, Your Honor. And that's.
But why is contempt the proper vehicle to adjudicate that question?
Well, Your Honor, we already had an order that had been entered. In other words, the order from 2004 required DRHI to pay my client upon the rezoning of the property for all additional lots that were created by his land.
But it didn't say to pay how much.
Well, exactly, and that's why we had to go in and.
But we have cases in contempt that says you cannot hold someone in contempt for something that is not clear and definite.
Well, Your Honor, and that's why he was not held in contempt, and this is why I set it up the way I did. We went into court. We actually
on a rule to show cause to hold him in contempt.
We had a hearing to determine what amount was owed.
I know, but the first thing that happened was a rule to show cause.
Well, Your Honor, that we went in on a petition for rule to show cause because that was how to reopen the case, and it was clear that they had rezoned the property without notifying my client. It was clear that there was an obligation that was due. We had to actually adjudicate what amount was due, and that's why we had the hearing, which occurred in May of 2013. We had a basically a hearing with witnesses from Fairfax City, witnesses from the developer, my own client, and we had a hearing to determine how much was due under this portion of the order that says that once the property is rezoned, there's an additional amount due. If we couldn't have had that hearing, obviously the court had to determine how much was due, because otherwise you have a clause, you have a paragraph in an order that's a final order, and we would have no way to enforce it. I mean, my colleague talks about going and filing a new contract action. Well, we already have an order that requires them to pay for each additional lot that's created, $70,000 for each additional lot. They did that in 2007. They filed the rezoning plans in 2010. We went back into court to determine that they had liability under this clause. Once that determination was made, I then went back and asked the court to issue the rule, which they did. I believe the date would be September, and that's the actual rule to show cause that was pending. But first, we had to go in and determine how much was owed under this paragraph. Otherwise, this paragraph, there would be no way, it would be meaningless. We would have a judicial order in which my client could never get paid. And for him to have to file a whole new contract action, well, there was already an order which specified exactly how much is due. And I take issue with my colleague in that saying that this is a trying to rewrite a contract. The contract's already been litigated, and we have a paragraph in the order entered by Judge Klein which says specifically, further adjudged and decreed that at any time, that at the time any subdivision plan submitted by DRHI for the development of the property sold by Mr. Hamback are approved by the City of Fairfax, in the event that the plans submitted by DRHI permit the construction of six or more individual residents, DRHI shall pay to Mr. Hamback $70,000 for the sixth lot and $70,000 for each additional approved lot. So in other words, this order on its face is anticipating a future event. It's saying to the developer, you can take title to the property now. You can take title to the property. You can go ahead and submit your rezoning plans, submit your development plans. But if there's a future approval of that, you're going to owe this money. So my colleague's argument had always been, well, if there was not the subdivision plan done by the time they took title of the property, they don't owe anything. Well, that's impossible. The bottom line is this: Judge Klein's order specifically laid out that there would be this future event. Well,
but all of your argument assumes that we conclude that contempt was the appropriate vehicle to get where you wanted to be. And I don't think you've answered that question.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's the only vehicle, because if I have tried to relitigate this issue, first of all, we have a contract from 2000 that's already been litigated in 2004.
Well, how can you square it? You're asking the court to hold them in contempt to pay a sum that was not adjudicated, when our case law is very clear that it has to be a definite direction and order in order for there to be a contempt finding.
Well, Your Honor, if that was the case, then what would be the point in having this order? Because, again, I have an order.
So you say this is a definite direction?
It's a matter of addition. It's a matter of multiplication to come up with the actual amount due, but the obligation is concrete from this order.
So is this your position that a court can use its contempt powers any time somebody fails to pay a monetary judgment?
No, ma'am. It's not a Justice Kistner, it's not a monetary judgment. What you
Well,
have
what is
here,
it then?
It had not yet been liquidated. In other words, if someone's asked to perform a future event, and I'll look at, the, for example, the case of Henderson, where he was supposed to take apart the dock, and he never did that. When there's a future event that's supposed to happen, and that event does not happen, and the court has contempt power to make sure that event occurs.
But that wasn't a monetary judgment.
Yes, that's correct, Justice. It was not a monetary judgment. But the bottom line was that was an event that was going to happen in the future that did not occur. This event was, if they obtained a rezoning, they had to pay the additional money to my client. Now, that's
so, Mr. Peterson, if this order had said that on a given date you shall pay an additional $350,000 to the seller, and they had failed to pay that, are you saying that you could have come back in the court then and asked the court to hold them in contempt for failing to pay the $350,000?
I would assume so. I mean, if it's laid out in the order that they're supposed to pay that, because this was a specific performance. This is not a question where it's a tort suit and you get a judgment you're trying to collect. They're taking title to my client's property based on a contract in which they were required to pay a sum certain. And that sum certain itself was bifurcated between an initial payment and a payment that would be due upon rezoning. So basically, this contract was essentially dropped into this order where, again, once they obtain the rezoning, at that point, they have an obligation to pay him that additional money as part of the order.
So you're saying it's a specific performance that makes this a unique situation?
Yes, exactly. This was inequity. And this case is so old, actually, the 2002 case was inequity. So you have a situation where a party in equity is forced to give title to his land unwillingly, and the other side had an obligation to pay for it. They paid for a little bit up front, and the rest they were going to pay when once they rezoned the property. Subsequently, they rezoned the property. Now, the matter's already been litigated at this point.
Well, let me ask you this question. Once it's been adjudicated, if everything you say is correct, and I'm not sure I agree that it is, but everything you say is correct, once it's been adjudicated, don't you just have a money judgment that you would enforce like any other money judgment?
And, Your Honor, we have a money judgment now from the petition to rule to show cause. I mean, we're trying to collect the money judgment. The bottom line is, Justice Millett, if we had had to file a whole new lawsuit, then this order itself would have been meaningless. What would have been the point to
go to? Well, one of your arguments, I understand it, is that this court has no jurisdiction because it's an appeal of a contempt order. So is this an appeal of a contempt order, or is it an appeal of a money judgment?
Well, Your Honor, it's not my appeal, so I don't think I would say it's.
But you argued that we didn't have any jurisdiction.
I did at one point. This is an appeal of a contempt order, and I'm not quite sure why I'm here. I always understood that this was a contempt proceeding. It went to the Court of Appeals. This court granted cert, and now I'm coming.
That's why I'm asking you. It looks like a money judgment to me, and you're saying it's not. It's a contempt order.
It's a contempt. No, this has been a contempt proceeding from the time we filed it. It's always been predicated on Judge Klein's order. We've always proceeded under that. Again, everything we did was styled as trying to enforce the terms of this order as written. My argument would be is that under the Rainey case, under the Epley case, there's always been cases in which the court can order a monetary judgment as part of a contempt proceeding. But I think this is where I
let me up to one more time. Is it your position then, if it had been 30 years before they got this rezoning, you'd still be able to come back on a petition
yes.
for judicial cause?
Yes, absolutely. Because it's
is there any finality then in these?
Well, I think under. I think there would be a situation where, a judgment, I think it's only good for 20 years. But to be honest, Justice Millett, again, the way this was ordered, it entered. And my client objected to it. This is the order that gave title. It's open-ended. It says anytime there's a future rezoning by this party. And they made some argument at the trial court that they use their builder entity, and so it's different. But they're not arguing that on appeal, I don't think. The bottom line is, this party had the obligation. This party rezoned the property. This party then failed to pay my client. And there was some murkiness as to the details as to how many lots were allocated. And that's why we had a hearing. And we had these issues hashed out before the trial court judge. And the city testified and the developer testified. And an amount certain was specified to comply with this order.
Now, I want to go back to the question Justice Millett asked you. Your position, I think, is that this is a contempt proceeding and it shouldn't be in this court. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, the final order that was entered in this case says that a judgment shall be, and it's hereby entered for handback against DRHI in the amount of $350,000. What is that but a judgment? And he also finds him in contempt. Don't we have both, that we have a monetary judgment and a contempt finding?
Well, Your Honor,
Yes, or not? I mean, that's what the order says.
Well, again, Your Honor, this has always been a contempt proceeding from my perspective. The judgment was entered because that was the remedy that the court chose. The court could have done a per diem fine. The court could have put somebody in jail.
But it didn't. It entered a judgment.
It entered a judgment, and again, under the cases of Rainey, under the case of Epley, courts are allowed to enter judgments as part of their relief. Now, this is not a collection of a judgment because the judgment wasn't sitting out there existing. Again, this was a specific performance where my client was required to deed over his land, and part of the compensation was never paid. And this was the part that was never paid. And so, therefore, we were trying to enforce the payment of that unpaid compensation for the land dating all the way back to 2004. That is the distinction between, you slip and fall on a banana peel and you get a judgment and you try and collect the judgment. No, this was a situation where a gentleman in equity was forced to deed over his land. A portion of the purchase price was paid at closing. The rest of the purchase price was deferred. And then after the rezoning, after the development, it then came due. And that's what we were fighting, was to make sure that they paid that portion, which was due, not under the contract, it wasn't under the contract, but under this order, which, again, is what required the conveyance of the land in the first place. And that's the most critical argument I can make, Justice Kinzer, to go to your point as to whether or not I'm trying to use the courts to enforce a monetary judgment. I'm trying to use the courts to enforce a real estate transaction that was done in 2004 and was never fully paid for.
Does the order... of September 20, is that subject to execution? Because I'm sure you're trying to.
Yes, in fact, I had a garnishment,
okay.
And so it's been bonded.
All right, well, if that's the case, then it is a civil judgment. You wouldn't be able to execute it.
Yes.
All right, well, 8.01670 gives this court jurisdiction over appeals of civil judgments. So on the question of which court, the Court of Appeals,
right.
or this court, has the ability to actually hear this appeal, it may very well be that both courts do.
Your Honor, you may well be right. To be honest, at this point, we've been chasing this thing for so long, we just together, we may be in the United Nations for the moment. But I think the bottom line is, and again, my colleague and I have sort of crisscrossed all over the Commonwealth in this case, is we're just trying to make sure our client was paid the full purchase price for his land. This was the amount that was outstanding. This was the rule to show cause, because there was an entered order, was what we used. I believe that the facts, that there's sufficient evidence. The only thing I did feel like the trial court judge missed on, and otherwise I felt he wrote a good opinion, was there should have been prejudgment interest, because the bottom line is the subdivision plans were filed back in January 8th, 2010. The final site plan was filed in May of 2011, and at that point, under the plain language of Judge Klein's order, that money was due and owing. And this is a $12 million development. So that money was due and owing to my client and was never paid. And the only other part is on the attorney's fees issue. Judge Smith just didn't really rule on it one way or the other. And again, my client's seeking to enforce an order dating back to 2004. He's had to spend a great deal of time and money on that, and hopefully this is the end of the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
I want to just light on three statements made by opposing counsel during the course of his argument, I think highlights and supports the correctness of our position in the court's questions to the appellee. He said at one point that they reopened the case, and he also said that the order specified how much is due, and that the objective here has been to recover the full purchase price of his land. And I think all of those things support our position. Number one, they reopened the case to try and present three different legal arguments that they never present in the case below. They're barred from doing so now by virtue of Rule 1:1. Number two, if, as he says, order specified how much was due, and they're just trying to collect, as I said in answer to Justice Kinzer's question earlier, then bring a breach of contract action. Contempt is not the appropriate vehicle here. It would have been breach of contract. And as I also earlier argued, they're not going to bring a breach of contract action, because once they do that and the court looks at the contract.
What about his argument that this is unique because it's a specific performance case?
Number one, it's a specific performance case against his client. We weren't told that we had to specifically perform something because we weren't going to close it. Number two, we did abide by the contract. And number three, I think that you correctly identified another issue with respect to this. When is their finality? Under their interpretation of what can happen, if DRHI goes back and buys this project again, and in Fairfax we are having a lot of that happen. We're having people come in and buy neighborhoods and tear down everything and put up higher density. Under their argument, 10 years down the road, if we do that and we get higher density in that project, we have to pay them more money again. They are reopening this case to get more money. They were never happy with the money they got. That's why we had to bring the specific
counsel
suit.
Is this a contempt proceeding?
It is. That's the way they brought it.
Why did you file here?
I'm sorry?
Why did you file? You filed both in the
court? Oh, because of the entry of, as I explained when I appeared to argue the writ, I think, and as I think Justice Lemons pointed out, there's, in this particular instance, there were two things going on. One was, can there have been a contempt hearing? And could we be found in contempt? And by statute, that is an issue that the Court of Appeals is to address. But we also had a situation where there was a judgment entered, and this court has sole jurisdiction to address that issue. So I took a dual-track approach, because under the circumstances I had to, And then this court combined those two appeals to hear the public.
Thank
you. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.
Fear routine, another versus Chin.